pour
Thank you,
présentation, par
Madam Speaker.
Merci.
Thank you, honorable members, for this opportunity to address this honorable house. Not at my best today because I don't feel very well, but I'll certainly thank some of my constituents, Machapi in particular, for all the bush medicine that she made available to me to allow me an opportunity to make my contribution to this debate. Madam Speaker, before I get into the meat of the matter, as they say, permit me to ask this Honorable House to join me in congratulating Her Excellency Dame Paulette Louisi on the quality of her delivery. I think that Her Excellency has taken things to a new level in terms of the quality of both her English and her Creole. And I think that she has become a fixture in the opening of Parliament. And I hope that all St. Lucians will listen to her over and over again so as to appreciate the true quality of what this very fine lady has said. Of course, it only goes to show what happens when you don't play politics. The office of the Governor General. We found the lady there. She was not appointed by us, but we left her there. We had no difficulty with that. And then you take that and you juxtapose it against what was done to Sir George. The throne speech that he was given to read and then summarily dismissed by the very same persons who want to talk about cruelty and victimization. It's a tremendous relevance. It shows the character of the individuals opposite. Madam Speaker, as the budget debate, appropriation bill has progressed, I have sought as much as is humanly possible to understand both the rationale and logic of the arguments being presented here by members opposite. I have, with all the patience I can muster, sat quietly to listen attentively to what is being presented. Having come from the school that teaches that one should first understand before seeking to be understood, I have listened with extremist-like conviction. Yet I remain at a loss to reasonably rationalize the opposition's virulent, illogical, and self-serving attacks on the administration of Prime Minister Keir. Every member on that side of this House has attacked the government and accused members of every imaginable crime, every possible transgression of trampling the human dignity of St. Lucians and causing injury to every tenet of good governance, every molecule of ruthlessness, mismanagement, victimization, and raw, unfiltered arrogance is being put forward as the hallmark and rallying cry of this administration. To quote the member for Castries East in particular, this government is comprised of vindictive, arrogant, rudderless, clueless spin doctors who spew lies, damn lies, and statistics. The leader of the opposition chimed in by referring to the Minister of Agriculture.
The member is in the House. He can never find a quote in my budget.
The leader of the opposition chimed in by referring to the Minister
in the House as usual, which is blipless. I never
as
said
the worst quote. Minister of Agriculture.
There is no record of that on any speech I made. You can't find it. Speak the truth.
Honourable member.
Speak the truth.
The leader of the opposition chimed in by referring to the Minister of Agriculture as the worst Minister of Agriculture in the history of St. Lucia and produced his version of statistics to support his assertions. He followed that with a salvo of venom aimed at the Prime Minister and the Minister of Works. In a wanton disregard for collateral damage, the Prime Minister proceeded to give a chronology of companies, mentioning names, exposing people. The leader of the opposition, I must use an acronym for him, L-O-O. It means loo. You know what a loo is? A loo, you know what a loo is? In some countries, it is referred to as a toilet. And we know what goes in, and we know what comes out. Madam Speaker, I will stoop as low as you say it is, but let's deal with you all. Madam Speaker, the collateral damage that's being caused to the people of this country, to the workers, is intended to puncture the soft tissue of cynicism that often finds fertile ground for accusations of corruption and graft among ministers of government. But what is the source of all this venom? Why is the leader of the opposition and members opposite, why are they so shaken up by a simple statistic that was presented by the Prime Minister? The Prime Minister spoke in terms of 4.4% growth. And a considerable amount of time has been spent trying to debunk this particular statistic. We've listened and we've heard. There have been all sorts of comments with respect to all the things that did not happen. How could you have that kind of growth in an era where there is a storm, there's drought, there are all sorts of headwinds against the economy? How could you possibly have that level of growth? Well, the statistic is not ours. It came from the office. It was read out by the Minister of Finance, but it came from the ECCU. And it was done as a result of a rebranding exercise. Now, this rebranding exercise, Madam Speaker, is a very simple exercise in which a number of statistics, a number of areas are rebasing. The rebasing exercise has to do with a number of statistics that were not actually considered in the past, but are being considered now in order to give a more accurate assessment of what is going on. Now, I'm going to allow the Prime Minister and Minister of Finance to proceed to deal with this particular issue when he sums up. But what I will say is, having listened to all what the opposition had to say in terms of their attacks on members on this side of the House, let me say this. We have to ask ourselves that behind everything that you see, there is something else. I've always said to you that you must look behind what is going on and what is being said. If you look at a stick, you put a stick into water, you see it bent. If it was actually bent, there would be no need to study light refraction. You see the sun rise, as they say, and I've said 1,000 times. If the sun actually rose, there would be no need to study astronomy. And if the Labour Party can be taken by everything that they say on that side of the House, there will be no need for elections, politics, nothing. Just take them at face value and put them in there. But the thinking mind demands to know why. The unthinking mind only wants to know, what is it I can get into? What's going on? And more than at any other time in the history of this country, the people of St. Lucia need to think for themselves. So let's think together. Let us think together and start thinking about where we are. Madam Speaker, the leader of the opposition referred to the rebasing exercise as a lifeline. He called it a lifeline because I suppose he wanted to say that regional or sub-regional prime ministers, they really had nothing to say, nothing that they could hold on to. And so he not only spoke about St. Lucia, but he spoke about sub-regional prime ministers, because he said they threw the prime ministers a lifeline. Madam Speaker, I'll tell you something. I don't know that it's necessary for him to have gone that far. Because in my mind, what he's doing is bringing not only the ECCU, but also the office of the Governor General or the Governor of the Central Bank into disrepute. I don't think that these people are out there to throw lifelines. But if you think about it, by having the rebasing of this particular statistic and the changing of things like debt to GDP, it puts these countries in a more favorable position if it becomes necessary for them to proceed to do any borrowing. You could get it at better rates. It's a number of things that could be done from that statistic, which is to the benefit of these countries and to the benefit of the people of this country. And what I will say to you, Madam Speaker, is that while members opposite continually sit there and wish the worst for the government, which effectively means that if you pray for the failure of this government, you have prayed for the failure of St. Lucia. But you know, this government is going nowhere. You know why? Because the people of St. Lucia are smart enough to understand that we live in a very difficult world. This world, Madam Speaker, is in crisis. What's going on in the world today, Madam Speaker, is something that we all need to respect. And we need to teach our people to start preparing themselves so that they can manage their personal lives and assist their government and work with their government as a team so that we can ride the storms that are currently facing the international community, including St. Lucia. Madam Speaker, this is a small island. A small country. When you look at how we are rated and designated in the world, they don't rate us as poor countries. Poor countries, if you have that rating, you have access to a number of loans, concessionary loans and grants that we do not have access to. We are rated as a middle-income developing country. And because we are rated in that particular category, it is making it extremely difficult for us to access these concessionary loans. A number of the OECS countries and CARICOM countries are coming together in an effort to have a rebasing of that particular exercise so that we can be rated in a category that will allow us to be able to access these particular loans. Madam Speaker, are the members opposite living in a bubble? Are they living in their own little world that they created all for themselves? I put these people like persons who live in the Matrix. You saw that movie they call The Matrix? Where you plug something in the back of your head and you believe that you're in a real world and you're not. That is how I see these people. The way they talk and the freeness that they talk about giving. You believe that, you know, they're going to take St. Lucia once they get into office at some point in the distant future, very distant future, and transform St. Lucia. Take it from where it is. It's not in this planet. Take it and put it on another planet somewhere. And when they put it on the other planet, all of a sudden it's going to be the planet of milk and honey. So it just keeps flowing. Because as far as what I hear coming from members opposite, we have a situation where all the realities of what confronts countries will disappear. And they can just come in now, provide free computers, provide all sorts of things that they are promising the people of St. Lucia. Madam Speaker, it is opportune at this time to review the realities of global existence in the context of current events in order for members to have a true appreciation of what the government has achieved. Madam Speaker, as I said earlier, the world is in crisis. I repeat, the world is in crisis. There's contagion everywhere. The world is also undergoing monumental change and shifts in global economic power, a shift in national perspectives, and a new march towards democratic principles and cultural reengineering. Now, we talk about democratic principles. And I'll tell you something. You see what's going on all over the world. Look what's happening in North Africa and the Middle East. People are going out there and demonstrating for freedom. A government that respects democratic principles aligns itself with democratic countries. The same people who talk about all sorts of things concerning the people of St. Lucia align themselves with people who have no respect for the democratic principles of their citizens. That's the reality that we have to deal with. And so, what I will say to you is, the time is coming when what you see going on in North Africa and the Middle East is going to happen there too. Because whilst you hear of all sorts of growth in that particular country, I can assure you that that wealth is not being spread amongst everybody. There are hundreds of millions of people there who want their freedom. And even those with money want more freedom. So let's see who we align ourselves with. And I'll tell you right now, Madam Speaker, this energy crisis, and in fact, it's not really a crisis. It's a crisis because we have to face it every day. But it's a false crisis. It's a crisis that's being perpetrated not because there's a shortage of oil, but because of all the speculation that's going on in the currency markets throughout the world, and in the commodity markets throughout the world, pardon me. The reality is, Madam Speaker, that bankers and commodity traders are out there pushing up the price of oil and hoping that they can push it up even higher. So those on the lower tier continue to make more money, and they go in and out, trade in and out of the oil, and they make a whole lot of money doing so. And it's causing interminable damage to the rest of the world. This is a crisis that's not unique to St. Lucia. Everybody is feeling it. In the United States, what you pay at the pump in the morning is not necessarily what you pay at the pump in the afternoon. This is the situation that we're facing. But I have been, it was said by one of the members opposite, I believe again it was a member for Castries, no, actually it was either the member for Castries East or the member for Sucre. I'm not too sure which one it was, Madam Speaker. But I will say this. He said that, and I'm not quoting but paraphrasing here, that I said that it's the people, what the people want the government to do. They ask for the pass-through mechanism. Well, I didn't say that, but it's true. I'm not so insensitive as to make a comment like that, because I understand that the people are feeling it. But what we have to accept here is that members opposite were part of the rallying cry, give the people their money. Because the picture that was being painted was that when the price of oil went down and government was recouping, there was more money being made by government, but you can't consider it as money that was being made. We were recouping money from all what had been extended previously to subsidize the price of fuel. Because when it was $140 and $130 and $120, and it remained in those spheres for so long, the government was putting money in there to keep the price stable. I distinctly remember Sir John saying on many, many occasions that you've got to keep the price stable. Oil is too important a commodity in this country for you to have it going all over the place. And that we must focus on keeping the prices stable. And so I too felt that it was important. And I will be honest to the people of St. Lucia and say that in the Cabinet of Ministers, I was one of those who did not agree to the pass-through mechanism. I never felt that it would be a good thing because there's no way that the price of oil would have remained low. Well, it's gone back up. It hasn't reached the levels that it was in the past. But if you're responsible, one could have said, okay, it's gone down. Give the people a little bit more of a rebate on the price. But no, there was a chorus of criticism of the government. The talk show crew, the talk show brigade, those who are paid to go on the radio and call. Well, there are those who paid to go on the radio and call. So while they're attacking and vilifying the government, give the people their money. Well, the government agreed. And the member for Catherine East said in this house that when the people speak, you must do what they say. Well, fine. That's what you wanted. You got it. But is it in your best long-term interest? That is the important thing. So now, we have to face those realities, and there are no easy choices. There are no easy answers because we don't produce oil. The mighty United States, in which 50% of the energy needs are met by coal, that is produced right there in the United States, they have a problem. They have a problem in terms of employment. They have a problem with respect to housing. Their economy has only been kept alive and registering growth because of massive injections of stimulus money. Their entire stock market was kept alive because you may have heard the term too big to fail, which was something that was applicable to companies that it was felt was so big and important, like IMG and others, Ford, Chrysler, General Motors, all of these companies. They felt that if these companies failed, it would have been a disaster for the economy. There could have been an entire global collapse of the financial system. That's what's happening there. In the United Kingdom, what's going on in England? You watch your news, what do you see? Families who have traditionally received money from the dole, etc., and for their children, that's being cut off. There's a massive austerity measure taking place in the UK, causing grief to many people. This is what they're facing. We heard of the collapse of economies in Ireland, and more recently, Portugal was going to the EU to ask for money, a bailout, to save that country from collapse. This is the reality that we're facing in the world today. And then you look at the wars that are going on now. Look at what's happening in Libya, Syria, Egypt, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Yemen. But you want to say St. Lucia, things bad? Look what's happening over there. And what happened in Libya could not have happened at a worse time for us. I heard one of the politicians say that Rufus complaining about Libya because they have to give him the money. That kind of foolishness. You only all want to talk about low blows. The OECF has established relations with Libya. Libya opened the embassy in St. Lucia. Libya is opening a development, establishing a development fund and a development bank. The development bank was being established in St. Kitts because that is the home of the East Caribbean Monetary Union. And the investment bank was being established in Antigua, each of which were to be funded to the tune of $100 million, US dollars. Individual countries, including St. Lucia, were slated to receive specific amounts of grant aid. In the case of St. Lucia, somewhere in the region of $10 million. To assist us. So when we sit here and we think that what happens overseas does not affect us, you have another thought coming. Everything that's going on out there affects us. We are not isolated. But because we're small, we're starting to operate on the basis that let us work together within the region. The sub-region, the OECF, the wider region in terms of CARICOM. so as together we provide a more potent force for bringing across issues that affect us and affect our people. Madam Speaker, I can only continue to stress that in spite of all what is being said by members opposite, the reality is that we are in difficult times, that we're in crisis mode throughout the world, and while the BRIC countries, and it's no longer BRIC, it's now BRICS, because it's thrown in South Africa towards the end of it. So right now, you know, it's Brazil, it's Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Excuse me a second, ma'am. While these countries are showing a separate level of development in the sense that they are showing very strong levels of positive growth, but I believe that that is so much of a disconnect from what's going on in the rest of the world. And it's causing problems as well, Madam Speaker, because you talk about rising food prices. Do you know why food prices are rising? Food prices are rising, Madam Speaker, because of the shift in taste of people in India and in China. You have so many new people moving out of abject poverty. I'm sure many people can remember years and years ago in St. Lucia. You wanted to eat chicken, you went in your backyard, you lopped off the neck of a chicken, and you cooked it and you ate it. You plucked it or whatever it is. That's what a lot of people did. But people don't do that anymore. Everybody goes to the supermarket now to buy the chicken. Well, that's what's happening in China. That's what's happening in India. People are getting richer and richer, so they no longer want to pound some paste in some mortar and pestle. They want to buy cereal. They want to buy computers. They want to buy all these things. The quality of life and the standard of living is increasing. So there's more demand on all of these commodities throughout the world. And because of the ethanol situation, what has happened is that a lot of farmlands have gone into the production of foods for ethanol, like corn. So there's sugarcane. So there's less food available, and there are many, many more people demanding food. There are rich countries in the world today who are buying millions of acres of land in Africa. The country is buying it so that in the future they can feed their people. That's what's going on in the world today, Madam Speaker. That is the context in which we, as a people, have to start thinking about what it is we're doing. And this is the context in which this government is planning and preparing for the future of St. Lucia. We're not just out there wishy-washy talking about this and that and playing little small-time politics. And the people of St. Lucia, they can feel it, you know. They can sense it. Madam Speaker, we have...
Honourable members, just find the phone,
please. I wouldn't hurt myself. I'm still going to turn these things off just to ensure that I'm not hurting my situation here. Turn this off, you guys. Madam Speaker, in this environment, you know, let's juxtapose what happened with this administration versus what happened with the previous administration. We're not casting aspersions here. No. You know, when in the past administration, the world experienced the most aggressive growth and the greatest level of prosperity in the history of the world, you know. I mean, the world, you know what used to happen at that time? Anybody who has done some sort of partial study of what goes on in the world will know that the biggest investment that the average person makes is in their home. That's the biggest investment you make. The investment is in buying a house. The average person. That's the biggest thing that they usually buy. I mean, how many people buy, I don't know, a plane, a railroad? But your car, second, the house first. And the way the system in the United States and in the UK and the developed countries works You could buy a house for $50,000 today. If tomorrow that house is revalued at $60,000, not $50,000 is revalued at $60,000, you now have $10,000 worth of equity, assuming you paid the house in cash. So all of a sudden, you have, in many cases in the U.S., things were so nice at the time that you could walk into a bank and they'll give you a credit card or they'll give you a home owner's line of credit where you have $10,000 to spend. People were taking vacations, buying second cars, buying computers, buying furniture, putting additions to their home, and the economy was just humming and humming and humming. Following week, there was so much demand for houses because they made it easy for anybody to buy that you just found out home prices just kept going up and up and up and up and up until the bubble bust. The bubble busted when we got in power. All the time the previous administration was in power, the bubble was growing bigger and bigger. So you know what that meant? It meant that people had disposable income. So banks were lending money all over the place. People were coming down here, there was adventurism in investment. People were paying top dollar for everything. Hotels were going up because there was so much demand. People were building condos because they had so much money they could buy a second home or a vacation home on the equity of their home in England or in the US and Canada. All the markets were humming. Things were great at that time. What did they do? Did you see any savings? Huge current account surpluses? Money going aside for rough times? A proper sinking fund to deal with all the borrowing that they were taking, that was taking place? No. Now, well, there you go. Nine loans with no sinking fund. But the fact of the matter is, the world was in an era of prosperity. You saw all kinds of people coming to St. Lucia talking about they want to invest, they want to build this, the Parity, all these different investors came to St. Lucia. And they were spending money like it was going out of style. Well, when the bubble burst, the banks, especially a particular bank called Singer Freelander, that was the bank that was lending the most money in the Caribbean, Irish bank, it went out of business. Right? Was it? Actually, they had branches in Ireland which loaned to these people, but the bank itself was it Finnish or something like that? Anyway, the Icelandic bank, that's what it was, Iceland. That bank went out of business, and all of a sudden, there was no more money available. So when they talk about, where are the investments? You don't have any new investments. Well, nobody's lending any money now. They haven't been lending for years. Credit hasn't eased up. And the people with money, you know what they do? When things get rough, they don't spend. They take their money and they put it away. They put it on fixed deposits. When the stock market was crashing, people didn't know where to put their money. They didn't know where to put it under the mattress. That is what this government has had to face. These are the headwinds that we have had to overcome. And so when you look at our budget, it's not a Chris Gayle budget. Voodoo. It's slow and steady. That's what you do when there are storms. If you know anything about sailing, you know that when there's a storm, you pull in your sails, you start the engine, and you go slow and steady. If you go out there and you play cricket, you don't want to try and hit the ball when the atmosphere is heavy, the new ball is moving, and the bowlers are fresh. You study the bowler. That's what you do. And you prepare yourself and get your eye in. This is what this government is doing and has done. We're going to play our shots, you know. That's coming. We're going to play our shots. But we're weathering the storm. We're seeing the moving ball out. That's what we're doing, Madam Speaker, because the environment called for slow and steady. It called for stimulus. Madam Speaker, let me say something. to members of this Honorable House. You know, what's the name of this building on Bridge Street?
Blue Coral.
Blue Coral. You know how Blue Coral came about? Because a government, through an organization, decided that they're going to buy a building and renovate it. Now, there are a lot of things that have been thrown out there, that the company was in a little bit of difficulty, and the government supported it by buying that. Nothing wrong with that. There's something called public sector investment and private sector investment. The leader of the opposition said that the government cannot develop the country on its own. It cannot. The private sector has a duty and an obligation to invest. Because we create the enabling environment, but it is the private sector that ought to drive the economy, drive growth, drive employment. But when they don't do it, especially when you have a private sector that's not as diversified as you would find in a developed economy, the government now has to step in and pick up the slack. So, Blue Coral by itself was not bad. But when you mismanage it to the point where to this day it can't properly open, to this day tenants are complaining, after mega millions of dollars have been spent with huge cost overruns, 20 million of cost overruns, of the workers of St. Lucia's pay, the workers of St. Lucia's security when they get old. That's why most people will tell you, okay, more home or NIC. You know who started NIC, Madam Speaker? Or at least was part of the team and instrumental in NIC being formed? A man called JMD Buske, who was the Minister of Labor. I was a little boy. And I remember, you know what came from the party of members opposite at the time? Buske want to steal your money. That's why he want to get them to take money from your check and put it away. There were demonstrations in Castries. At the time it was National Provident Fund. But that's a fact. And it only goes to show that anything that you try to do in the interest of this country is criticized, vilified, and dragged through the mud by members opposite. So now, it's the airport soon. It's the airport soon now. It is bad. Taiwanese, bad. I want to thank the Taiwanese, Madam Speaker. I want to thank Ambassador Chu. And I want to congratulate him for finally wresting himself from the tentacles of members opposite. Well, you want to say, you speak about Ambassador Chu this year? All of a sudden, his hands off. You know why? Because they know they made a mistake. And if St. Lucians want to know the truth, as Minister of External Affairs, I will tell you that the leader of the opposition has written to the President of Taiwan on numerous occasions attempting to stop the Taiwanese funds from coming to St. Lucia because he says they were being used for politics. When it was being offered to them and they refused to take it, he in particular, that's what the St. Lucian people are facing behind the scenes. Rochamel is nothing. Rochamel is nothing.
What about the one kid driving?
Madam Speaker, as I said before, Madam Speaker, as I said before,
honourable members, allow a member from Shuzel to continue.
When private capital dries up, the government must step in to keep the economy going. You will hear members opposite say that things ain't running, that there's this disconnect between growth and a mother with a little child. There's this disconnect between growth and the fellas on the block who can't get work, the young people. We have plans for them. As I said, we're going to play shots. at the appropriate time. When you see this government, we'll tell you, yes, maybe things not running as fast as you want it to run, but it's running. It's running, and this government has overcome every crisis that has confronted it. I don't need to rehash them, the earthquake, the drought, the worst hurricane. But civil servants get pay every month. There's some work going on in the community, as the Minister of Work said. Hundreds of thousands of dollars to at least keep you going. It's a compassionate government. We're not saying to you that you have money to just go and drink beers every weekend and drive your car from Beaufort to Castries so you could take a line. Or you could have four or five women that you have to check for the week. You got to be careful. Yes, I know. You all mentioned four or five women. Be careful. Because the Labour Party propaganda in Shoshone is I have 12 women and two pregnant. That's the kind of nonsense you're playing with politics. Like, I'm telling you, I'm telling all of St. Lucia that is Labour Party's politics in Choiseul. I broke my mother's arm looking for money. All kind of nonsense like that. It's on the internet. That's what they're doing. That's their politics. I'm not afraid to repeat it because it's not true. But that's the kind of politics they play. You understand? That's the kind of politics. So when they come in here, they want to talk about don't go there and be clean and this and that and the other. Play the nastiest politics you can think of. But fortunately, I've been in Choiseul for 25 years in politics, and I was there before with my father who was there for 20 years in politics. The people know me. People know me. You can't tell them who I am. I achieve on their behalf. And my achievement is my self-confirmation and my self-definition. And that is what it's all about. So you could talk all the nonsense you want. My son, according to the lady in Rivadore, my son, that's what they call me. And I will remain their son, working for them and in their interest. But Madam Speaker, when the government goes and invests in the Dyer Mall, for example, I mean, there's room for argument in anything that you do. But isn't it an exercise to create employment and create economic activity? Now, you could come with options. I mean, everybody is entitled to do that. But in doing so, has the government not to some extent mirrored what was done with Blue Coral and taken something and moved on? The litmus test is that having established a company to do that, independent and borrowing, now that we've done that, are we going to bring it within cost? Are we going to make it profitable? Is the structure going to withstand the scrutiny of all those who would wish to criticize it? These are the important things. But we're not, don't say we're not doing anything and nothing running. We're doing. Madam Speaker, the Shariki Mall, when the Ministry of External Affairs moved there, people don't understand things or take them in context because it's easy for people to go out there and criticize. I don't know all the details with respect to that. I was not the one who said, let's go to Shariki Mall. I don't go and tell people where to go. I don't tell them how much to pay a potential tenant or landlord, I should say. And that's where we were. But I was glad we went there. Because one, my staff could not function where they were. My ministry was hobbled and disabled as a result of it. And if by doing so, the landlord and the investor got a good tenant, then that was all in the interest of St. Lucia. Let's not be myopic and start thinking there's one set of solutions and another set. That investor, in the most turbulent times in the history of the world, put his money on the line. He took a chance. And today there are hundreds of people employed. There's no employment generation. Hundreds of people employed. And I see people, St. Lucians, walking around with a certain sense of pride that when somebody visits them, they have somewhere to take them and they can see how nice it is and how St. Lucia is moving forward. And you know what it has also caused? Now, the mall across the street is improving. So they are now investing money. The monies that were out there that perhaps they didn't want to invest or they were reluctant to invest, perhaps wisely so, they have now come out there now and they're investing. They're creating jobs. There's price competition. The whole economic environment is more vibrant and things are happening. That is what you try to do as a government. Create jobs. Just put people in the right mood because they talk and talk about some study they did on something, consumer sentiment or something, and everybody is in a bad mood. Go by the mall. You all say I'm the one going in the casino. I know, that's your Labour Party propaganda again. I've been to the casino once and it was on a tour by the owners. They wanted to show it to me. That's the only time I've been there. And I went in there to see. But you all always want to put something on me. I'm the target. I'm the guy you all want out of the house by coming back to haunt whoever is there. I'm not going nowhere. Madam Speaker, all these things are intended to show that we're positive in what we're doing. And, you know, really, members opposite have no legitimacy to talk about this government. They have no legitimacy to talk about what has happened in terms of the rental of any mall or any building. Madam Speaker, let me speak a little bit about New York. Just so you'll understand. I have some stats here. You know, I speak about New York and I do it conservatively because the ambassador to the UN at the time that the Labour Party was in power is a gentleman that I like. In the same way that the current leader of the opposition thinks that the Minister of Agriculture is the worst Minister of Agriculture in the history of St. Lucia, I think he's the worst leader of the Labour Party in the history of the Labour Party. I think the former head of the UN would have been a better leader and proved to be a better leader. It was just a question that timing was not on his side. And he's a man, well, Spider, you retired him politically, but let's be gracious to the gentleman, because he's a gentleman in many, many respects. But there are gentlemen who have gentlemanly taste. So the same people who want to say, oh, we want office this, as though we're paying $100-something thousand now, but we paid nothing before. They don't say that we paid $80-something thousand before, where we were before. It wasn't free. And we're in more space. We're in a bigger space now. But during the course of that administration, this gentleman, the OECS, a number of the OECS countries, I think Dominica, Grenada, St. Lucia, perhaps St. Vincent, I'm not too sure St. Vincent was part of it, but you may be right, shared space with the Commonwealth Secretariat. And that space that we had, it was 1,824 square feet of space. So we could have a nice little office at the UN with enough staff to take care of our business and so forth. But the last administration decided, that's too small, man. We've got to have more style. We've got to look more powerful in the world of international diplomacy. So, what did they do? They went and got 6,959 square feet. They moved away from the Commonwealth Secretariat. They said, oh, we're moving out of there, and we're getting our own office. So they went and got 6,959 square feet, almost 7,000 square feet, at a price of $36,604.16 a month, U.S. So they paid in one month more than was being paid for an entire year. You have legitimacy to talk? For what? If you go there, there's so much wasted space. Offices with nobody in it. Just laying there, fallow. Then they went and bought a house out of town, spent over $1 million for the house, bought it at the height of prosperity in the New York housing market. The housing bubble burst. The house became worth way less. The gentleman decided he didn't like the house anyway, so he didn't want to stay so far. His wife didn't want to stay up there by herself, whatever transpired. So he decided he wanted to go back to Manhattan. So the house stayed there. Water was left in the pipes. Winter came, pipes busted, carpets were destroyed.
And remember, you have 10 more minutes to finish your presentation.
Madam Speaker, I would like to invoke Section 3210 to allow the member a further 90 minutes to complete his presentation.
Honourable members, the question is that Standing Order 3210 be invoked in order to allow the member for Chauzel an additional 90 minutes in order to complete his presentation. I now put the question. As many as are of that opinion, say aye.
Aye.
As many as are of a contrary opinion, say no. I think the ayes have it. The ayes have it.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. So this is what we have there with respect to the house. Eventually, government ended up having to sell the house. There was no use to it. I mean, a house sitting there, swimming pool, fancy house, all sorts of things, just languishing out there, taking all kind of weather, becoming weather-beaten. Madam Speaker, coming into office, if we had factually achieved nothing, if that was a fact, it would have been justified, you know, because the amount of time we have spent cleaning up the mess that was left to us by the previous administration. The Hellenite Center, everybody heard about all the wheeling and dealing that went on there. House ended up in people's hands, people gave money, says theirs and so on, this government having to go to court to get the thing back for the people of St. Lucia. Madam Speaker, look, I could go on and on and on, but I recognize that St. Lucians are not stupid. I recognize that as a people, we are going to be given the opportunity to make that choice and to decide who is truly deserving of an opportunity to continue our program. We want to see St. Lucians to see us playing our shots. We haven't played our shots yet, but we're still in the wickets. And we're going to stay in the wickets because we will not deny St. Lucians this government's ability to play its shots. Now, Madam Speaker, in looking at all of the messes that we had to clean up under the previous administration, let me see if I can find this one here. I want to spend a little time so that if I have to get cut off, I would have dealt with the issue. Where did I put it? Hold on a second, Madam Speaker. I want you all to bear with me. Let me see if I have it here. Madam Speaker, this is a very topical issue, and I think it's one that we need to spend a little time on because at the end of the day, Guy, what happened? You took my papers? Yes. I think it's important for St. Lucians to analyze what has happened. And more than anything else, in the context of this budget, to understand why this government has to continue to work as hard as it does to try and bring economic prosperity and a higher standard of living to the people. Madam Speaker, the member for Castries Central brought up an issue relating to the seabed of St. Lucia. The member for Castries East spoke about it, and they spoke in very jocular fashion. Almost the member for Castries Southeast My apologies to the member for Castries East. He has enough troubles already with that wall. He doesn't need any more. So, let's leave it there. The what color are they painting the banisters? Red? The in any event, Madam Speaker, the member for Castries Southeast, he spoke about it in jocular terms. Now, at the risk of being accused of having come from Labrie, because that's where all these things come from, I will explain jocular means, you know, you're just laughing like it's a joke. Well, it's not a joke. This is the worst thing that has ever been committed against the people of Sindh. Rochamel, $40 million, it's a joke compared to this. I say that with all the seriousness, and I ask every St. Lucian out there to pay attention to what transpired. Madam Speaker, in March of 2000, an agreement was signed between the leader of the opposition and a gentleman by the name of Jack Greenberg, granting an exclusive lease over St. Lucia's marine area, extending to the exclusive economic zone areas for the conduct of seismic exploratory work to be undertaken by his company, RSM Corporation. It was a U.S. company, and as I said, it was owned by Jack Greenberg. That was in March of 2000. The lease is granted for an initial period of 4 years to March 2004, but with a facility for them to apply for two-year extensions during the exploratory stage. Listen carefully, the exploratory stage. Effectively, the exploration stage could have continued up to February 2008. 4 years for the lease, two terms of exploration of 2 years, so it could have continued to 2008, the exploratory phase. So in other words, you have the lease and you can go and explore to see if there is oil, minerals, a sunken ship with treasure. You know, they found a ship not too long ago. It had over $1 billion worth of gold in it. So that's the kind of action that was going on there. So if you're talking about royalties, we're talking serious money, especially with royalties to the minister. It was said further that if oil and gas is discovered, or anything that was discovered for that matter, the agreement further stated that RSM may apply for a further license for development. So after they have explored, if they found anything, oil, gas, gold, zinc, cobalt, whatever, they could now apply for a development lease for 30 years with a facility for a 20-year extension. The lease could potentially exist, therefore, for 58 years. It could have also expired after the initial four-year period. It could have expired after 4 years. Bear with me on this one. I don't want to lose you all. I want all members to pay attention. It could have expired after the initial four-year period, but for the amendment signed by the leader of the opposition, referenced in the following paragraph. I'll tell you what it is. So they could have expired this whole thing in 4 years, but the leader of the opposition put an amendment in there. September 2000, remember it started in March. September 2000, 6 months after the agreement is signed, RSM had conducted no actual exploratory work. They'd done nothing. But instead, they presented an amendment to the agreement which was signed by the original parties to agreement, namely signed by the Lu, leader of the opposition. This amendment, Madam Speaker.
Leader of the opposition.
Yes.
I was about to say.
No, it's an acronym. It's an acronym, Madam Speaker.
I now understand because I was coming to say no name calling.
No. It's not name calling at all, Madam Speaker.
It's leader of the opposition.
It's the use of an acronym here to describe the leader of the opposition. Okay. So, Lou, leader of the opposition for short.
Okay. But I don't want you to say toilet, okay?
I quite understand, Madam Speaker. Right. Thank you. Thank you. First of all, Madam Speaker, the amendment effectively enlarging the agreement area. So the agreement, we started to make it bigger. It also invokes Section 24 relating to something called force majeure, or majeure, I don't know how you pronounce that. Force majeure, as in manger, majeure. The effect was the suspension of all of RSM's obligations. By signing this amendment, the effect was the suspension of all of RSM's obligations under the agreement until such time as the government established beyond all doubt St. Lucia's maritime boundaries and control over petroleum in all the area. So, by putting this force majeure amendment in there, it says that you don't know your boundaries, you don't have control over your boundaries, so I don't have to do anything, but I have a lease. And until you establish those boundaries, my lease remains intact. I don't have to explore, so we're not in an exploratory phase, we're not in a development phase, I just have the lease. Because your boundaries are in dispute. The government ratified the enforcement of the force majeure provision, which was based on the proposition that St. Lucia had boundary disputes with its neighbors. I want everybody to pay attention. It gets nice. At the time, St. Lucia's boundary with Martinique was already demarcated. There existed a gentleman's agreement with St. Vincent. The fact that boundaries are not demarcated does not mean there is a dispute. Barbados conducted its seismic surveys in 2006. You know they have oil in Barbados. They found oil. So that means there could be oil in St. Lucia. And when Barbados conducted its seismic studies, all they did was send us a diplomatic note to say, hey, this is where it is. We're going there. No dispute. And notified the government of St. Lucia of the exploratory work by simply sending us a diplomatic note to that effect. Fundamentally, RSM believes that until St. Lucia demarcates its maritime boundaries, which is a very, very costly exercise, the company is entitled to lock down the area and retain an exclusive lease over St. Lucia's entire marine area. We're not talking 1,000 acres. We're not talking 10,000 acres. We're not talking 100,000 acres. We're talking in square miles. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking Queen's Chain. We're not talking beach. We're talking about the entire, and that is St. Lucia's sovereign territory, you know. It belongs to us, and everything that's under there belongs to us. The government of the previous administration allowed somebody to lock that down. Now, during the force majeure period, when all of RSM's obligations ought to have been suspended, because remember they say there's a dispute, so they don't have to do anything, RSM continued to pay rent to the government for the lease of the area, which was supposedly under dispute. They kept paying rent. Obtained and reformatted. The company went and obtained and reformatted data belonging to St. Lucia, stored in Barbados, and collected by Petro-Canada during a previous seismic survey. They visited St. Lucia in early February 2004 for 1 week with a vessel, during which time Greenberg attempted to conduct seismic explorations, but discontinued as he claimed the water was too rough. By this time, were it not for the signing of the force majeure amendment, the 4-year exploratory period would have nearly expired. So, but for that amendment, that could have expired and we could have moved on. March 2004, 4 years later. Instead of applying for an extension of the agreement as the initial four-year period had expired, Greenberg presented a second amendment to the agreement dated 29th March 2004. The amendment signed by the same leader of the opposition granted an extension of the exploratory period for a further 3 years to March 2007. So after all that, the leader of the opposition then grants, puts in another amendment to the agreement and extends the exploratory period for a period of another further 3 years, all the way to March 2007. It also contained again, in that amendment, the same force majeure provision stipulated in the first amendment, wherein, and I quote, all of RSM's obligations are suspended. They have no obligations. All of RSM's obligations are suspended until all boundaries are resolved. And it goes on. Again, the previous administration accepted this position. Now, honorable members, Madam Speaker, strictly speaking, if all of RSM's obligations were indeed suspended owing to boundary disputes, as stipulated in the force majeure provision at section 24 of the agreement, there would have been no need or obligation for RSM to even apply for an extension of the exploratory period. Nor should RSM have been performing the activities detailed in paragraph 5. Because you don't have to come and bring a vessel to explore. You don't have to do anything because you've already said that the thing is under dispute and you have no obligation. So therefore, nor was RSM to have been performing the activities detailed in paragraph 5 above, were this truly the case. So if this was truly the case, they shouldn't have done any of these things. Continue to pay rent, dealt with matters relating to coming to St. Lucia, dealing with data. But you know, there was one that I left for now, for this period. During that time, Mr. Greenberg attempted to sublet or farm out the agreement to a Chinese oil company. The reality is that the gentleman, but we'll get there, because there's more. The belief is that Greenberg does not possess the necessary funds or intends to expend the necessary funds to undertake this project. Lock it down. You have a 50-something year lease. You go to somebody and you say, just, I'll sell it to you. Give me whatever. How many millions of dollars or whatever it is, and it's yours. And then you pay the royalties. Also, Madam Speaker, note well that by obtaining an extension of the exploratory period, the option to extend for two consecutive two-year terms is also preserved. This is important for RSM because remaining in the exploratory period avoids its obligation under the agreement to expend US $3 million for the drilling of one well during the first two-year extension. So you see the little trick here? Extend the exploratory period by giving him another lease. So you don't force him now to go into the... The extension of the option is then the options. You preserve the two-year options. Because if he moves from the exploratory period and exercises the options, there is a clause in there that says you have to drill at least one well, which will cost about $3 million. So we're saving Greenberg by putting in that second amendment. I don't know. Coco Macacri. 2005 and 2006, RSM continues to pay annual rentals to the government for the lease area whose boundaries, according to Greenberg, are disputed. Hold on. March 2007, the three-year extension of the exploratory period granted by the previous administration, namely the LOO, ended. RSM, through a gentleman, a former permanent secretary, and a gentleman who was, I believe, at the UN at some point, all over the place, presented an amendment to sojourn because 2007, things changed. We're in power. He presented an amendment to sojourn for another 3 extension of the initial exploratory period. So they wanted another extension again, which also contains the same force majeure provisions as stipulated in the previous 2 amendments. This was not signed by sojourn, who indicated to Mr. Hunt that the matter would have to first be discussed at cabinet. In October 2007, we've gone from March 2007 to October 2007, RSM, through the same gentleman, resubmits amendment to PM King at this time and attaches a check in the sum of US$26,000 to pay for the lease for that year. This is the request that we are currently dealing with. Madam Speaker, this came to the Ministry at that particular point in time. We saw this check coming in and a request for an additional amendment. In December of 2007, by letter to PM King, RSM states inter alia that it has already completed all of the seismic work. That's on page 2 of that letter. It is noted that Greenberg refers to the gentleman as my trusted associate. But who are these people working for? He referred to the gentleman in the letter as his trusted associate. Okay. In other correspondence, he refers to him as my representative. That's how he referred to the gentleman. The same gentleman. In March 2008, by letter dated February 2008, a letter is collected by the same gentleman from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs officially requesting the RSM file, because the file was nowhere to be found. The file was nowhere to be found. That's talk. Everybody want to talk. This government is this and it's that. Yeah. The whole seabed, everything, hundreds of square miles. C'est tout bagaille. J'ai pêché qu'il faut faire ça. The ministry requested the file. March 12, 2008, a company called Freshfields, a legal firm, which had represented the government of Grenada in a similar dispute with the same individual, provided our opinion to the ministry, presented a detailed opinion to the ministry, including draft letters to be sent to RSM and its representative. Particularly, the gentleman has kept the entire RSM agreement file and critical information is lacking. Notwithstanding, Freshfields advises that the agreement is commercially unfavorable to the government of St. Lucia. Whoever signed that deal is commercially unfavorable to the government of St. Lucia, further they stated that it did not meet the normal standards in which compensation is given. April 11, 2008, letter dated 4th April 2008 from the Ministry of External Affairs is couriered to Mr. Greenberg, inter alia requesting clarification and specific information on the agreement, as all documentation is with his representative. The 2 US, whatever it is, dollar checks submitted to PM King are returned to RSM in the letter on cash. Bravo to you, PM King. Return the money. It's not in our interest. May 2008, a letter is received from Mr. Greenberg, dated May 16th, which recognizes that its request for an extension has not been executed. RSM continues to assert, because now the government of St. Lucia and RSM in a problem, because they want to continue to exercise all of these things. And we recognize that, wait a minute, somebody did something to St. Lucia here that is terminally devastating to our country. Just completely took away huge swaths of this country's natural resources, its entire seabed, and everything under there. You're going to compare that to what? Rochamel? Rochamel is an insect compared to that. So, by this letter, which recognizes inter alia, this gentleman has sent a request for an extension and has said that this extension has not been executed. Now notice how easily they used to get executed before. No problem. Extension 1, amendment 2, let's go, just come my brother. Royalty is talking. RSM continues to assert that the agreement is in force majeure. So they're saying majeure. So they're saying, look, it's not our fault we haven't done anything. This agreement is in force majeure. Okay? And until you resolve your boundaries, this is the situation with us. So we need to get this extension because that's the case. However, an email from Greenberg to the gentleman, his representative, requesting that the file be returned to the government is attached to the letter. Greenberg requests that government advise him of its position once the file has been returned. In other words, what you're going to do now. In July of 2008, a meeting was held with Freshfields and representatives of the Ministry of External Affairs. Letter dated August 6, 2008, and we're going to finish shortly, is sent to RSM Greenberg from the ministry, indicating that the gentleman has still not returned the file, and that now, we're talking from April, now in August, you know, has still not returned the file, and that government's ability. So basically, all we can say now is that we can't even entertain what you're coming with because we don't have the file. That's all we could hold on to. We don't have the file. There's nothing in there. We don't even know what's going on. So we indicated to them that basically the gentleman has still not returned the file and that the situation request for the extension is hampered because we don't have the file. Government also notes specific requests for information made in previous letters to RSM have still not been provided, and we reiterate our inability to respond to their demand for that extension based on a lack of information. August 15th, the gentleman brings a box of documents to the ministry. Not Greenberg, the representative, the former PS and former UN guy. I don't know if he was on radio. December 22nd, 2008. Letter to RSM from the Ministry of External Affairs, dated December 15th, 2008, is couriered, indicating that the gentleman has returned what appears to be partial copy of the government's file. Government confirms its position, previously articulated in correspondence, that there are no boundary disputes that impeded petroleum exploration, that RSM has not acted as though the agreement is suspended or enforced measure. They didn't act like that because they went on explore. They continued to pay the money. They did all of these things. So that force measure, argument, it doesn't hold water to us. That the agreement lapsed in March 2007, that this government's position, and that the government does not intend to extend the agreement at this time. That the government intends to initiate future competitive prospects for exploratory work and anticipates inviting RSM to participate when it puts it out to tender. December 22, 2008, letter also sent to the gentleman requesting a reminder about the government's file. Madam Speaker, thank you for bearing with me on this. I will just say this. The substantial difference, because this is important to conclude this, the substantial difference between Grenada, now remember, this same company had done the same thing in Grenada and the same thing in St. Vincent. So they were going from one island to the next. The only thing is, and at the other islands protected themselves. They did the obvious. They did what was within the law. This government did not. The government at the time did not. The former administration. The substantial difference between Grenada's contract with Greenberg and St. Lucia's is that under Grenada's contract, Grenada required RXM to apply for an exploration license as required under Grenada's laws so that the exploratory work could commence once the license was granted. However, instead of applying for this license, within 2 weeks of signing the agreement, RSM invoked the force majeure clause under the agreement, which suspended all of its obligations to perform until such time as Grenada demarcated its maritime boundaries. Again, a very costly exercise. This is essentially a stalling tactic, which would enable RSM to keep the offshore territory of Grenada locked down, while attempts were made by RSM to farm out or sublet the lease. Though Grenada argued against the validity of the force majeure clause, the tribunal, they took this to an international tribunal. It cost the government of Grenada $4 million, 10 million EC to fight that case. The government of Grenada, it cost them that amount of money to fight that case. That's the kind of mess these people put us in. You asking? Just listen. Yeah, but though Grenada argued against the validity of the force majeure clause, the tribunal ultimately ruled in Grenada's favor, primarily because RSM, for whatever reason, had never applied for the license, and so the merits of the force majeure argument was never determined. So we can't go now and say there's a force majeure argument, so we can say there's a case. What do you call it? There's a previous... Yes, there's a precedent. So we can't say that. So if we go to court with these people, which is the only way we get out of that, by the way, that's what it's going to cost us. And we have no way of knowing whether or not we can win. They locked it down real tight. Only people with a good knowledge of the law can lock it down that tight. That's right. St. Lucia's contract was executed with RSM at a time when Grenada had already fallen out. So that was there in the region. People knew about it, and yet it was done here, and an amendment was put in. But here's the worst part. St. Lucia's law calls for a license. It's in the law that you need a license. The law states specifically, here it is, the Minerals Act of St. Lucia. It states prohibition of prospecting and mining except by license. A person shall not prospect for or mine any minerals except by authority of a license granted by the Governor General and in accordance with the terms and conditions specified in the license. So there is a law that says you need a license. No license was sought and no license was given, when we already knew that the license was the mechanism that was used to get out of this. I can't tell you why. I'm just telling you the facts. Consequently, when RSM presented its contract to St. Lucia, an agreement which largely mirrors that of Grenada, the requirement to obtain a separate license was excluded from the agreement. That was excluded from the agreement. It is noted, however, that Section 4 of St. Lucia's Minerals Vesting Act provides for and necessitates such application for license in the circumstances. Notwithstanding, under Article 3.1 of St. Lucia's agreement with RSM, the exclusive license was inherently and automatically granted on the government's say-so, the government of the J, the Loop. Thus circumventing the need to apply for a separate license as required under the Act, and as was contained in the Grenada Agreement. 8 months into the agreement with St. Lucia, and having conducted no actual exploratory work, RSM invoked the force majeure clause by virtue of an amendment to the agreement, which the government at the time executed, stipulating that until such time as St. Lucia's maritime boundaries are demarcated, all of RSM's obligations are effectively suspended. Ah, boy. It is noted that RSM also concluded an agreement with St. Vincent, where, like Grenada, a separate application for a license is required outside of the agreement. Article 27 of St. Vincent's agreement, dealing with termination of the agreement, provides for, and I quote, termination if the company is in default, and the minister has cancelled its licenses pursuant to the Act. Provision is further made for termination of the agreement where the license granted expires. There is no equivalent provision or any provision whatsoever expressed within St. Lucia's agreement for termination of the agreement in any circumstance. While termination is listed within the table of contents, the relative and substantive provision is completely and deliberately absent from the body of the St. Lucia Agreement.
THD law, that's what it's
called. St. Lucia's argument, therefore, must therefore be based largely, so, in terms of trying to get St. Lucia out of this and get your entire sea back. We have lost our sea, our sea bed. The sea is not ours. It has been leased. It has been given away to Greenberg for royalties. This is so bad that I was shocked when I saw this. Until such time as St. Lucia can get out of this agreement, the country's offshore territory remains locked down, such that no other contracts for seismic exploration can be entertained from any other investors or exploration companies. St. Lucia continues to receive interest requests from companies able to perform such work. Barbados has proceeded to have seismic explorations conducted and has advanced to the stage where the country has since invited bids from investors to develop the industry. St. Lucia was approached in 2008 by the same company who completed Barbados' seismic exploratory work, but was unable to accept the offer because of the RSM agreement. This company continues to demonstrate interest in conducting exploratory work in St. Lucia, but unlike the RSM agreement, does not require a development license to be issued once the exploration period is complete. This leads to the hardship of the RSM agreement, as once the exploration is complete, and this is the tough part, once the exploration period is complete, if it is ever commenced, because they can say, we can't explore, you all haven't demarcated your boundaries. Article 3.2 of the agreement mandates that a development license shall be granted. So you have no option. The same company must get the development license. You can't say, well, you did the exploration, so now we're going to invite bids for development. The same company must get the license, and they must get the license for 30 years. And upon application being duly made, the development license shall be renewed for a further period of 20 years. 50 years. With the initial exploratory period spanning 8 years, once St. Lucia has first got out of the boundaries quagmire, this agreement is set to bind St. Lucia for 58 years, not including the period it would take to demarcate the boundaries. Note, we are not yet even in the exploratory period, as the agreement is currently suspended. Estimated legal costs and expenses should this matter proceed to arbitration, estimated in the initial stage, US $2.15 million, about $6 million BC. So far, the ministry has expended $67,000 in getting legal advice, etc. Madam Speaker, when people come here and they start talking, let them talk, you know, because this is what has been done to St. Lucia, a butchering of our assets, a butchering of our patrimony, a complete disregard for what belongs to the people of this country. And these same people come and talk to us about what we are not doing. No matter what happens here, Madam Speaker, this is so serious that I don't think it's anything to be laughed at or even joked about. All this talk about the man on the street, all this talk about the people on the block, the fishermen in Beaufort and all this sort of thing. Madam Speaker, I don't want to lose my train of thought here. I spent a lot of time on this because I felt it was important for the people of St. Lucia to know. I felt it was important for the people of St. Lucia to analyze, to take it into consideration, so as to see the true nature and character of those seeking to lead this country once again. I don't understand why it is that we should bother ourselves. Because in spite of all that disconnect that is being spoken about between this government's policies and the realities of life as it relates to the man and woman on the street, I am always heartened, Madam Speaker, in that whenever this government mobilizes its party, we have many, many people following us, whether there is rain or mud in cul-de-sac. And yet when members opposite mobilize, they can't fill a bus. They have to put children in it to make up the numbers. And it shows that there is more of a connect between us and the people than there is between them and the people. The people have a greater trust of the man who is running the affairs of this country. They call it him rudderless. The leader of the opposition is a big rudder. He's a big rudder. You understand? He's a big rudder. But you know, there's nothing that is said by him that can be believed. At this point in time, supporters of the Labour Party don't know who they're voting for. Because when they look around now, the Labour Party is left on UWP. All what we don't want. All what has been criticized in this house by the leader of the opposition himself. Read his book and what he had to say about Tuju. And the other gentleman that's running in Choiseul. I'm not going to go down the nasty road with him. I'm waiting to see how far he's going to go, because I have way more information than he thinks I have. But what I'm saying to you, Madam Speaker, is that the reality is that what we have to deal with in that particular situation is such that people do not know who or what they're voting for. And if the leader of the opposition has brought these people into his organization, he has to publicly apologize to them for having said these things and said they are not true. He just fed them. If you cannot do that, then it means you are accepting people who you vilified in the worst way into your party. What's that about? Madam Speaker, everything in the politics, everything in this country now is politics. Everything has been politicized. Solutions have been turned against solutions for politics. And the manner in which things are conveniently done is nauseating. When the whole question of Taiwan and Sir John's illness came to the fore, it was, boy, Sir John is a great man. These fellows, who they think they are, tackling the great leader and going against his word and all this kind of nonsense. But the same people took Sir John to court, to a commission of inquiry for $27,000. And I saw Sir John cry and say all his life he worked for this country. And that organization dragged him up the stairs of the Parliament building, dragged his reputation through the mud for $27,000, saying he gave a contract to some fellow in Dufour to do a road before election. Was it $30,000? That's what we're dealing with. The same people who talk about vindictive, they refuse to give him a parking spot on the boulevard. But we vindictive? We vindictive? Madam Speaker, I have full confidence. There are people, when they're smart, they think everybody else stupid. That's the problem with some smart people. They just believe other people stupid. But there may be people in this country who are poor, but they're not stupid. Yeah, I know. I'm stupid. Madam Speaker, they make mileage on the health concerns of the poor and marginalized in our society. But let me give you the reality of matters relating to health care. I'm going to move on. Nobody seems to want to accept that the diagnostic capabilities of this country have improved substantially. I mean, you know what used to happen in the old days? Somebody gets sick, right, they show him or his anana. He'll be blessed. A gas keep going. You know, somebody dropped them. Mal, sorry, if I don't, you just live a BDP more. A munfei mal, usual life. That's what you used to get. So people did not spend a lot of money on health care. You go and see somebody, they give you la boule du masque, et puis a casse avant foncé, they finish with you. That's what they've done with you. Or they put a plaster on your chest and a cataplum and they rub your back and they're done. Today, doctors don't want to touch you if they don't know exactly what's happening. So you have to go for tests. You have to go for scans. In other words, we have first world healthcare at first world prices in a third world economy. So a lot of people, you diagnose a person with cancer, they have to pay $3,000 for a treatment, but they can't do it. They just don't have the money to do it. So they come to the politicians, they want things to be done. Madam Speaker, we have to deal with that. But healthcare is expensive. And all of St. Lucia, through that health program, universal healthcare as the case may be, it must come into play to assist the people. Obama had one heck of a time doing it in the United States, the mighty, rich United States, because they said he's going to bankrupt the country with his health care bill. And he fought and fought and made concessions all over the place before he could finally get that bill passed. And even now, the Republicans are trying to have it repealed. It is not cheap. It is terribly expensive. And we have to understand, and we have to, as a people, become responsible enough now to assist in making provisions for our health concerns and our health care going forward. We have to do it. It is imperative that we do it. Madam Speaker, I thought I would mention this healthcare situation because I know it's topical for a lot of people. I have people in my constituency who come to see me all the time. It's really expensive. We try to assist them. But unfortunately, it's not something that we can help everybody with, and people have to understand that. I don't want to go into too many more things, Madam Speaker, because I think, you know, we've hit at the real kernel of the matter. But I must touch on the question of development in the South. And to give an overall view of government, how much time do I have, Madam Speaker?
Yeah, 55 minutes.
55 minutes, okay. The whole question of development in the South and development as a whole, this is not a matter that this government is not aware of. How do you develop a country like St. Lucia? The north of the island, for all its intents and purposes, has reached its physical limits. Where are you going to go? Land is expensive. You can go out there and build on the east coast, because the east coast, to a large extent, is unexplored, or I should say is undeveloped. But in doing so, it's going to be costly. You've got to put in roads. You've got to put in a number of things. The most important and the most logical place for future development of St. Lucia has to be the South. You've got to rebalance the country. We have a situation today, and it has existed for many, many, many years, where the people of St. Lucia, the young man, the same people they talk about, if he's intending to get something done, if he wants to get a job, if he wants to move ahead in life, he has to move to Castries in order to do it. He's looking at coming up to Castries to see if he can get a little job because he feels that the opportunities there are far greater than in places in the south. Coming to Castries means you've got to go rent or you've got to go in some uncomfortable situation at some family residence or some friend or something of that nature and look for a job. What it does is it creates more ghettos, more substandard living, more crowding in the capital, and it really causes a whole disjointing end of your development as a country. So we have an important responsibility to the people of St. Lucia to preserve what can be done in the south. Now, what happened in the past? Now, Speaker, it is very difficult, and I could understand his dilemma. He probably hates me now, the leader of the opposition. I'm sure he's going to try and get me. but at the end of the day, when he goes on platform and put lips on me, I smile. At the end of the day, what we're looking at, Madam Speaker, is a situation where the leader of the opposition was at that time the Prime Minister, the Minister for MDC, and the Parliamentary Representative for VFOS. Now you tell me, as the Parliamentary Representative for VFOS, your constituents, the people who have to vote for you, coming to you, they want land. And they will come to you because they know the dilemma that you're in. What are you going to tell them? No. You want them not to vote for you? You're going to tell them you can't go there? You're going to tell somebody move this person from there because he shouldn't be on that particular piece of land? No. What was done was something which created an absolute mess in the south of the island. People were sent on land all over the place. People were told, the authorities of the government were told, don't touch anybody. People were given all kinds of leases for government property in the south. In my constituency, in the area called Tiai, even today, there are hundreds of people coming to me with a piece of paper saying they paid $10 and they're looking for their lot. They want their lot. There are no more lots. This was so disorganized that you find that when you have a lot of land here, half of somebody's house is on the lot, the other half of the other person's house is on the same lot. A total mess. Prior to the 2006 election, land was sold for 10 cents a square foot in 2006. Now, I know there are people out there who like that. You know, if you can get land for 10 cents in 2006, you love it. And there were situations where there were people who had been on these lands for a long time, and you might say, okay, give them a concessionary rate. But at the end of the day, there was no money to ensure a proper development. So there were no roads. People built helter-skelter all over the place, and it created a mess. Today, this government has to fix that mess. In Beaufort, bearing in mind the importance of Beaufort as a development area, as a future for the future development of this country, it's absolutely critical that we have land rationalization, that we know how we can use the land. And if people decide that they're going to wait on a weekend when there's absolutely nobody around to go and quickly put up four pillars and put something on it, what are we supposed to do? If you allow one to get away with it, everybody continues to do it. It's not anything pleasant. But NDC, as a responsible organization, has taken a decision that they're not going to allow that situation to be encouraged. The leader of the opposition, during his tenure there, went out. And you know what he did? There were a set of people squatting in Bruceville. He gave them land in another part of Beaufort so that he could clear out the ghetto. You know what they did? They moved over there for a while, sold the lot, took the money and went back. That's responsible. We have an obligation to ensure that the future patrimony of future generations and the ability to generate economic activity is not compromised by people just going and building things all over the place. It's as simple as that. So it's not any hardship or wickedness or anything. People are told not to do it. They take a chance. They'll run up there and build it on a weekend and hope that, you know, you just You just leave them alone. So, Madam Speaker, I wanted to speak about that because, quite frankly, the leader of the opposition really, really created a mess for us in Beaufort, and we're still grappling with it. The development agenda that we're talking about in terms of investment is such that we have laid the foundation. We have spoken to a number of companies. We have spoken in terms of public-private partnerships, because really, at this particular point in time, investment dollars are so scarce that it's necessary for you to work with potential investors in an effort to get things done. At the end of the day, land sitting around doing nothing is of no use to anybody. But if that land can be effectively utilized and create economic activity, create jobs, bring a lot more people into a more skillful framework and develop them, then that is something that is positive for St. Lucia. Madam Speaker, I would like to say at this particular point in time that having set the basis for the future prosperity of St. Lucia, and we've covered a wide number of areas, I think it's important for St. Lucians to understand that no government can show its true worth and reach its true areas of development in 5 years. It's necessary for there to be continuity in government. It's necessary for people to give the government an opportunity to fulfill all of its plans, having come in at a time when things were extremely difficult and the whole global situation was extremely challenging. So at this juncture, all of the plans that we have put in place will be set back. It takes a while for you to deal with the civil service, for you to have the right people in place. Sometimes you come in there and you find civil servants who have their own political loyalties. And when you get in there, rather than work to see things move in a positive direction, some people can be quite obtrusive. They can be obstructionist, and deliberately so. I mean, that's a small minority. Let me make that absolutely clear. But it does happen. And if one person is in a key position and they decide to do something like that, it can create tremendous hardship on the minister and on the government. So I think the continuity that's needed for us to now, having weathered this storm, to take St. Lucia to a next level is something that we have to be given every opportunity to do. I want to just say, Madam Speaker, that, you know, we can't at any point in time as a people fail to recognize the tremendous contribution that the government has made to, in terms of subsidizing fuel, in terms of subsidizing LPG in particular. Now, I have my own concerns about LPG, because there's a lot of talk about LPG being something for the poor. Generally, it has been, but I suspect a lot of rich people are going to start buying 20-pound cylinders, okay, because of the substantial savings that they will make from those 20-pound cylinders. Sorry? I refuse to answer on the grounds that it may incriminate me. But the amount of money that government has invested there, I mean, up from last year to now, $6.5 million, I believe, is an accurate figure in terms of what government has put in to subsidize LPG. In terms of gas and diesel, over the past year, somewhere in the region of $8 million, $7.5 or $8 million. I mean, this government is responsible in that respect, in that we're trying to make things acceptable, try to make things easier on the little man. And people need to recognize that we can't cure everybody's problem, that our people have to develop a new sense of responsibility. The times where you could just go, or the period where you could just go out there and drink your beers and sit down on the block and have a good time, Guinness, whatever, this is over. It is important for people to now save so that the banking system can develop an adequate level of liquidity so that this money can be reinvested into the economy to create jobs and to create economic activity. So this is what I would like to say to them. I can't leave here, Madam Speaker, without at least congratulating the Minister of Home Affairs and the Police Department for a job well done. I mean, there was all this talk about crime, and deservedly so. But now, we're establishing diplomatic relations with places like Morocco. Well, we've established with Morocco, but with Montenegro and other countries. We're moving towards getting additional aid. Countries like Morocco have come on board, given us aid. India has shown a tremendous amount of interest in St. Lucia. Now, an Indian company has just agreed only last week to go about establishing a company within our free zone for packaging of pharmaceuticals, and they expect to hire something like 60 or 70 workers and move on to 150 workers in the south of the island within a year. So progress is now being made. We're now seeing that all of our diplomatic efforts are starting to pay off, you know, because the whole idea is that we're making our diplomatic offices less embassies and more areas for trade and investment. The idea is that we're not a big country that can get into all the global dynamics that are taking place. But what we are looking to do is to focus more on the areas of trade and investment, to get investment, to be able to cast a broader net, and to sort of reconfigure all of what we see in terms of investment. NDC now is looking at the whole situation and streamlining their operations so they can move more strongly into focusing on investment. And the whole question of developing land, developing housing, land, and so on, is something that ought to be moved to the National Housing Authority. Let them focus on that. And let us deal with the investment lands, the lands that can be used to create economic activity. And so we can narrow our focus, become more streamlined, and therefore become more efficient at doing what we do. And this is the strategic reason why the Ministry of External Affairs also deals with matters relating to NDC, so that we can cast a broader net with our foreign embassies and use them for trade and investment, so that we can bring more business, we can bring more assistance to St. Lucia, and we can develop more relationships with a view to bringing a sort of relief to St. Lucia in the economic sphere. So this is a carefully thought out plan. I want to take this opportunity to thank all my staff at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the staff of the Ministry of NDC, the NDC board and all the staff members there. I particularly want to thank the staff of the Ministry of External Affairs because, Madam Speaker, for months and months, they suffered tremendous hardship and worked under the most difficult of circumstances. And today, I see a new flair. I see people coming to work with a smile on their faces. They're bubbling, and they're focused on what they have to do for the people of St. Lucia. So I want to thank them for that and to tell them that I look forward to their continued cooperation as we move forward. Madam Speaker, there are a lot of plans as it relates to what is going on in View Fort. But I think it's only appropriate to put things out at the proper time. What I will say, though, is that the development of the airport, as much as it may seem like a cost, is something that underpins the very foundation of the development of St. Lucia and St. Lucia's strategic move forward. Without that airport, without that investment there, you cannot develop your tourism industry in the way that it ought to be developed. I think if what you do, Madam Speaker, is you must understand that in many cases, things don't happen because of logic. Things happen because of relationships. Things happen because you've developed relationships with people. These are important components of getting things done. And that is one of the reasons why there must be continuity in government. Because when you come into government, it takes a while for you to even establish those relationships, to know the players, to develop confidence so that people can have confidence in you and what you stand for. And if you don't do that, then naturally anybody coming in has to completely start all over again, and this sets the country back. We cannot afford that at this difficult time. It's important for solutions to recognize that. And no matter how you may feel about what's happening with your business, the amount of money flowing in the economy, you must understand that this is not a time to go changing horses. It's important for people to recognize that they need that continuity so that we can move forward and do what is necessary. So, Madam Speaker, I am confident about what is happening with respect to the airport. I have supported it from the very beginning. I think that we cannot do everything well. We must go in areas where we have a strategic advantage. We have yet to touch our potential in the areas of tourism as a major driver of this economy. We have not touched the potential that we have in tourism. We need to develop it a lot more, and we can develop it in a unified way so that the St. Lucian people do not feel that they're being marginalized by the presence of touristic establishments, that their recreational areas are not being compromised. We can do it, and we have to do it, and it will be done in the south of the island, and this will cause a complete rebalancing of St. Lucia and put St. Lucia on the road to much greater prosperity for our farmers, our fishermen, our crafters. Everybody will benefit from it, and I think that we're at a stage where we can really get this process going. Madam Speaker, let me just run briefly to my constituency. I don't like the member for Castries East. I don't have to spend a lot of time on my constituency, because I too believe that the people see the work that goes on there. They know what's being done, and as a result, there's really nothing much that I need to say other than to reiterate what the people already know. We have a tremendous amount of progress that has been made in the constituency. Everybody, I think, in the Chazelle constituency, no matter what side you belong to, I think there's general agreement and there's consensus in accepting that a lot of work has been done in the constituency. In fact, more work has been done in the Chazelle Saldibus constituency by this current representative than any other representative in the history of Chazelle, including GMB Bush. And Madam Speaker, when I stand in Chazelle, a lot of people don't understand what it's about, you know. I went around Chazelle with my father as a little boy, and I would see him stopping places and seeing people. He was regarded for what he was, and George Odlum put it very well when he said that he left me a, what did he call it? He said he left me a will, a patrimony or something to that effect. And he said it wasn't a monetary thing, like, you know, you die and you leave your children money and houses and so on. But what he left was a fund of goodwill. It was a fund of goodwill. And I've been able to go out there and build on that goodwill. And much of what I do is driven by the fact that when I lay down at night and when I walk around, I always feel that he's looking over me and saying, you do your best for the people of Chazelle. I feel that. And so when I sit there, even in the most trying times, even under the most trying difficulties, when people come by, and sometimes people can be so difficult, I just maintain my cool and I say, you're doing it for GMB, because he wants you to do it for the people. So when I drove by Miss Barbie, for example, a lady who had a post office in Debrel, which was taken away from her, elderly lady, and left her with no income, to the point where her standard of living deteriorated considerably. I won't go into the details. They're too morbid to mention here. I remembered stopping by Miss Barbie with him as a little boy. I remember him saying, Babsy, how are you doing? What's going on? And bringing little things for Babsy. And she was always so enthusiastic. She was always so welcoming, with a big smile on her face. That when I saw the condition that the lady was in, after having her livelihood taken away from her for politics, I had no choice but to come to her assistance. And that underpins what I represent. But I don't worry about supporters on the other side, because I work with everybody, and that's a fact, and people know it. And I will not give details, because I will not seek to embarrass other people. But at the end of the day, I am known to represent everybody in my constituency, to be welcoming to everybody, no matter what side you are on. All I ask is that you are respectful of everyone's opinion, and you do not compromise the development of the community for political reasons. That's all I ask. Other than that, some of my best friends are in the Labour Party or support the Labour Party. And they will look at me and they'll say, oh, I'm not concerned. But they won't come to me, some of them. But gradually, some of them do, because they see the light. And Madam Speaker, there are some critical issues that affect the people. The bridge that has been out at, in the DeVille area, the DeVille going to Delce area, that particular bridge, it's something that I've been discussing with the Minister of Works for too long. And I know he's trying his best, and there are a lot of challenges, But I will continue to fight to ensure that this is done. Whenever I hear anybody speak about things not getting done in their constituency, I can assure you that all of us have the same problem. I mean, I have a situation in Saldivar where the road has collapsed. It's practically gone. There's just a narrow strip. People have fallen in the thing. It's dangerous, but it has yet to be done. I have a situation on the road going through Roblo, going through Lamaze, where the same thing needs to happen, where again the road collapsed, and again it's dangerous. People speak about it all the time, but I can assure you that I'm working on it, and I'm confident that within the next few weeks that some these situations will be addressed. But of course, on a more positive note, we have the Fiat Road, which is scheduled to start very soon. That has been a source of some consternation for the people of Fiat. This road has not been done for a long time. I can't recall when it was done. In fact, the only thing I remember doing was some 10 years ago, or almost 15 years ago, putting some material on that road. And I think that's the only attention that it has been given in the last 20 years or more. But what's interesting, though, is that there was always a demarcation in terms of how roads were done in Suzhou. When you look at the industry area, where this road, that was the first major project that was done in St. Lucia after this administration got in. The industry road was deliberately left out of the development. I mean, we can go on and on. The Boaden Road, the Fossil Road. None of these people should ever forget the way they were marginalized and punished and how bad these roads were for how long they were bad. And we can say whatever it is that we want about this, but it is really a very distinct form of political victimization to not do these things and to keep these people suffering, because all the roads around it were done, but that particular stretch was left unattended. And if you look at the records, you will see the voting patterns of the people in that particular stretch. And you have to ask yourself, why? And so these people need to remember that. Madam Speaker, I started an important initiative of giving computers, a computer to the child who did the best or excelled in every year in primary school, child who came first. And this is such a wonderful thing because it has all the young people working hard at trying to win that computer. And there's nothing political about it, because whoever the child is who comes first, that is the child who gets it, no matter what school. So I don't bring politics into anything that I do, but I'm going to change it, Madam Speaker. You know why I'm going to change it? Because I've found that the child who comes first most of the time, is a child who comes from a very good family. Or should I say a very privileged family. And in many cases, they already have a computer. So what I'm doing is I'm going to ask the teachers in every school to recommend the most deserving child from the most needy family to be the recipient of that computer. And I think that would be a more accurate measure. So the teachers know the children, you do well, maybe you didn't come first, but you do very well, you work hard, and you're also from a needy family or from a family who has not, who really can't afford to get it for you. And you know what inspired this thing, Madam Speaker? I'll tell you what inspired it. The child who came first in common entrance in St. Lucia back in, I think it was somewhere around 19, no, no, it was, it was about 2005. So it was a young lady from the Mogouj Primary School. She came first in the whole island. This is not a child who came from any wealthy family or anything like that. And her mother came to me and she said to me, you know, I promised her that if she came first, I would buy her a computer. But I had no idea that she would come first. And the child came first, and she could not afford to get the child a computer. And when I saw this child, I mean, you know, from Fiat, the same place with the road, and I saw that here is this child from a rural community, humble, can come first in the island, I consider that worthy of the highest level of recompense and reward. And so this program started on that basis, and it has continued to this day and has gotten bigger and bigger. The crosses of St. Lucia of Choiseul received assistance from OPSR. I want to thank OPSR for what they did. They did a tremendous job in bringing the whole question of arts and crafts in Choiseul to the fore. And while I'm doing that, Madam Speaker, let me take this opportunity to say, to extend again our condolences to the family of those who suffered in Tropical Storm Tomas, not just suffered but lost their lives. And of note and of particular importance to me in Choiseul was Sabi and his family. That's really important to us. I think that Sabi was given the awarded posthumously the Medal of Merit. And of course I did my best. Well, I certainly brought the matter up in cabinet because I thought, in spite of having passed away, it's important for us to recognize the people who made a tremendous contribution in that area. And I'm not just saying that because the man has passed away. You talk to anybody in that particular industry and they'll tell you, look, this man was really a true patriot in the area of the development of craft in the Choiseul area. I want to mention the whole cafe area and particularly the appeals of people like Louvisca, who would often call Jukwa and speak about the fact that there was no bus shelter in the cafe gap. All of that is done. We've dealt with Jeffrey, Dakitain, Ravino. We're still trying to get a bus shelter for these people there, but of course there's just no land available in order to do so. However, Madam Speaker, I think it's important for us to recognize that this has been achieved and that there are a number of people who have been assisted in that regard. When it comes to sick people, Madam Speaker, there are persons who need our attention, who need to be given all the assistance. Certainly Louis and Kafir needs special mention here. She's a lady who needs our help, and that is certainly going to be forthcoming in the not-too-distant future. So, Madam Speaker, as I speak in terms of what has happened in Choiseul, I can't leave without speaking about the mini-stadium. We're building a mini-stadium in Lafarge. We have already secured close to $1 million EC for that purpose. And it's really a shame that some people would want to take this and politicize it. It was a request that was made to me by the sportsmen of Choiseul. They have always said that Choiseul has a wonderful playing ground at Lafarge. It's recognized nationally, but it lacks facilities. And so it is my attempt to make these facilities available. At this particular juncture, the architects are working on it, the engineers, the engineering team, and they're putting all the plans together and putting all the drawings together so that we can ensure that this project starts as soon as possible, but certainly within the next 6 months. So we have this mini stadium, and I am pleased to say and to thank, I wish to thank the government of Morocco for making this money available to the people of Choiseul and making that contribution. I noticed that the member for Groseillers and the minister who's responsible for community development and all that sort of thing has specialized in parks, you know, and so I want to ensure that people know that as much as possible as foreign minister, if I can get some assistance from my constituency, I'll do so. Before I go, because I notice the Prime Minister is back and he's probably ready to go, I can't move on without talking about the fisheries complex. The fisheries complex is a major issue for the people of Choiseul. This thing is causing, when I say this thing, Madam Speaker, it's almost indescribable because the pond is now a mess. They just call it the pond. The pond is now a mess. Ever since, it was always a problem because there was always a question of siltation, the sand coming in and blocking up the entrance. But on many occasions, you'd clear it and take a few months or several months, 3 months, 4 months, before it started filling back up again. Since Tomas, this thing has become unbearable. I recall when government spent $30,000 to clear the mouth of the fisheries complex, the operator of the excavator told me that he had cleared a certain amount of it, and he went to lunch. And when he came back from lunch, what he had cleared had filled back up again. Now, it costs a tremendous amount of money to clear this. And every time you clear it, within a matter of a week and so on, it fills back up. We can't just continue clearing it and clearing it. So what we have done is we have received assistance from the Japanese in order to purchase an excavator and a truck so that government doesn't have to pay a company to do it. But irrespective, we're certainly going to have to pay an operator. The excavator needs fuel. If it breaks down, it needs parts, etc., etc. So it is going to be a cost to central government to be able to maintain this. But the idea is to try and find a more permanent solution. I don't know if it's possible to get a permanent solution. I don't wish to blame the Labour Party for the manner in which it was done or where it was placed. Personally, I wouldn't have put it there because, to my mind, it destroys the picturesque facade of the Choiseul village when you're coming in from the sea, etc. So I think it's a bit of a monstrosity. But at the end of the day, it's there, it's done. The question now is, what do we do with it? We can't just continue to spend money clearing it, and then it remains that way. So when the excavator is purchased, and of course, they got a check from the Japanese, the check has to be cleared, the check has to move on. I mean, all sorts of things have to be done before you can actually obtain this piece of equipment. And I think it's necessary to clear all of this and put all of that into play so that we can proceed to do what has to be done for the fishermen. But I'm in a dilemma. I'm in a quagmire. I've brought the village council. I've held meetings with the Ministry of Fisheries, Ministry of Agriculture, in an attempt to try and resolve this problem. But it is not. There is no easy solution to this. You clear it today. A few days later, it's blocked up again. In closing, Madam Speaker, let me just thank a few people because I think we all recognize that this is the final session of this Honorable House in this term. I wouldn't say the final session, but certainly the final budget session in this term. And it's necessary for me to thank my colleagues for all the support that they have given me for the last few years, to thank all my staff, all the people who have worked with me, to thank my people in Choiseul for giving me this tremendous opportunity. It's not an opportunity that I take for granted. I recognize that I have to continue to work hard and I have to continue to prove myself to them. But I thank them for the opportunity and I thank them for their support. And I look forward to continuing to receive that support, not just in terms of elections, but in terms of receiving that support so that I can continue to work to improve things in the constituency. I welcome discussion. I welcome progressive discussion. I welcome discussions that are going to bring about improvements in the community. I'm less inclined to be to have a favorable disposition towards personal discussions unless they're absolute needs. But I think it's more important to develop the community and to bring along the rest of the people with it. So this is what I'd like to do. I'd like to thank all those who have stood with me in the most difficult times. I know that there will be more difficult times. That's the nature of solution politics today. Solution politics today is the nastiest that it's ever been. And that's not going to change until after this election. And perhaps even beyond it. I don't know. But what I do know is that at the end of the day, we will continue as a team, and I'm only going to be part of a team that is going to work in the best interest of the majority of solutions. At the end of the day, there's always a debate, and there's always a fight for ideas, and a fight for assets, and all self-interest come into play. But having said that, we have to look at things objectively and take the right decision in the interest of the majority of citizens. Madam Speaker, I want to thank you. I want to thank the staff of the Parliament Office for all the help that they have given, the kindness that they have shown, the members of the police force who are here and looking over, the Sergeant at Arms and others. I want to thank all of you, and I want to say to you, Madam Speaker, Godspeed, the best of health, and I hope to see you again very soon. Thank you. I don't know what I forgot. Oh.